Catholic Radio in Metro Detroit. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. Delighted to have back with me today on Church and Culture, Dr. James Jordan. I failed to call him doctor in the past. Now correcting that, he has a doctorate from very fine Eastman School of Music, very historic Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York, where Howard Hanson taught for so many years and created such a great legacy. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Deal. And Deal, it's just absolutely fine that we talk with each other just like this.
Okay, well, I'm a doctor too, but I never use it, so, you know, I don't insist on others using it, although it's nice to throw out every now and then.
No problem.
Now, we're going to talk about a composer. We're going to talk about a brand new recording that you and the Gloria Dei Cantores have made, but first, I want to play for our listeners a little snippet of something this composer has composed. Jordan knows what that is, but I'm sure our listeners have heard it, but they may not know the name. That's the 18th variation from the Rhapsody on a Theme by Paganini by Sergei Rachmaninoff, written in 1934. Jim, you can guess why I played that, correct?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'm going to tell you a little story. I mean, it's certainly one of the most famous pieces he ever wrote.
Indeed.
With chills running down my spine, listening to it. But interestingly enough, here in our community, we have a winter percussion unit, and they're actually doing an arrangement of that as part of their show this year.
Wonderful.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. What you hear is, in a way, that piece can come to life in a completely different musical realm.
Well, it's just got that thing, right?
It does.
And
everybody realizes it. That's the amazing part. Everybody in the room stops when they hear that tune.
No matter how familiar.
Exactly.
Now, Rachmaninoff, as we're going to discuss, was a Russian soul.
Indeed.
He was a Russian soul very much shaped by the Russian Orthodox Church. And although he got in a tangle with that church over wanting to marry his first cousin, we'll talk about that later,
mm-hmm.
he remained, as I am told and have read, a devout Russian Orthodox entire life, not a great churchgoer, but deeply believing. And
absolutely.
We're going to play a brand new recording of one of his two liturgical pieces, I guess sacred pieces might be better. A brand new recording that I received in the mail a few days ago, done by the Gloria Dei Cantoris. But what's really special about this is it arrived in a beautiful suitcase with a 53-page booklet, beautifully presented, illustrated, full color, and an SACD disc, which means surround sound, which is stunningly recorded, and I noticed that the engineer from Reference Recordings was used. And Reference Recordings, for those of you that don't know, is considered the label that presents the most perfectly engineered recordings that you can buy. You had, I think his name is David Johnson.
Well, do you mind a quick story about him?
No, I'm egging you on.
Okay, because I have actually a marvel. This is Keith Johnson, and he actually heard this work, The All Night Vigil, in the 60s in Russia. Now, just think about that for a minute. When you consider what we were looking at in this country and in that country and the relationship, to have heard that work, and he had always, always wanted a chance to record it. And that when he did that with us, that was his chance. He was a joy to work with. Because
well, I'm sorry I wasn't invited to hang out.
You know, his heart was in it as much as any of the rest of us. You know, I sang tenor in it. And, you know, when he would come out, you know, to move a mic or anything else, his enthusiasm was absolutely equal to any singer on the floor. It was incredible.
Including yourself?
Well, I would think so. I watched him, and he put a bright smile on my face every time he came out.
I should remind our listeners that Jim's not only a tenor in this Gloria Dei Cantoris, but also since 1968, their organist. Is that right? 68?
Actually, I came here in 88.
Yeah, I got 20 years wrong. So,
that's
a long time anyway. And
no, I will have been here 29 years this next year.
Okay, well, that's a long time. And
So
I want, before we play the first of several cuts of this amazing recording, which is, I mean, this is as nicely presented a CD as I've ever seen. And the music and the engineering match the excellence of the presentation. So, but I want to read something that just made me sort of drop my jaw.
Okay.
When I was reading from the conductor, Peter, was it Yermolov?
Yermolov.
How do you say it?
Yermolov.
Mm-hmm. Yermolov, who's Russian, of course. But he said, in the booklet, he said that the performance vision for this recording was to combine the pursuit of musical excellence with a search for the work's distinctly Christian content. And he goes on to explain that it was the intent of the recording to bring together forces, all of whom believed in the message of this piece. And I don't think I've ever read that on any LP or any CD or anywhere about
you see,
a recording.
that was the entire impetus behind doing this recording. I should give you a little further explanation, because we have a very, very long-time relationship with Peter Yermakov and his wife, Irina, because in the late 80s, we developed relationships here with people in his official title was the General Secretary of the European Council of Churches. His name was Glenn Williams. And our director at the time, Elizabeth Patterson, she and several others worked with him. And at that time, then, the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. And they went over for a visit. And we were invited to come over three times into Russia. The point being that our goal was to bring back to the Russian people something that they had not heard and that had been close to their heart. They had not heard for some 70, 80 years, many of them. And we were so fortunate to come across Peter and Irina, who came here all those years ago to help us, some of us native Kansans, learn how to speak Church Slavonic.
You mean we're not in Kansas anymore?
We're not in Kansas anymore. You got it. Yeah. We moved from Kansas to Moscow. And
when you hear those Russian bases open up, you know you're not in Kansas.
Well, interestingly enough, one of our activists who's here at the community is from Texas.
God bless him.
And he really, he's got the pipes that send us down there. But that was the impetus. And what happened is all these years later, Peter found himself rather re-inspired by the work. And he came back to Richard Pugsley, our director of choir, Gloria Day, and asked about doing this project for what you just said. He said, we want to be able to join all of our forces together from these various groups, but he came to us because, he said, you're monastic. You live this every day.
Yeah, and we're talking here about the Community of Jesus, which various groups of which we've had on Church and Culture quite a bit, and this is a monastic community. And could you describe a little bit about what that means in the context of the Community of Jesus?
Absolutely. I mean, we're a Benedictine community out on Cape Cod in Massachusetts. We have somewhat unusual in that we have sisters, brothers, and lay people here. But as the course of time has gone and the way our community has developed and the charisms that have moved out of here have really dealt with the arts. Music sprung up quite some time ago. We're, obviously you've just mentioned, Deal, we've been on with you before talking about Gregorian chant, which, of course, is at the heart of our daily life in terms of worship services. But the choir sprang out of daily life in this community. And one of the basic philosophies underneath our choir is to find the greatest degree of truth that we can in any style. We studied it. We do music theory, we do music history, we bring in linguists, we do everything we can to absolutely find the heart and soul of not only the music, but the people for whom it was written. And so it was an incredible joy all those years ago to get to go to Russia those times and take those pieces back. But then to do this recording was astounding because for those of us who had been on those trips, all of those memories just rose right back to the surface. And so that is something of what we were trying to capture and, in a sense, recreate for the listener in the recording, is not just this piece of music, but really very much the worship service that is being portrayed in this work.
Well, it comes across, and I should say before we play the opening track, that we have here not only Gloria Dei Cantores, but we have two Russian Orthodox choirs. One is the St. Romanos Capella, whose conductor actually is conducting this recording,
right.
And the Patriarch Tikhon Choir,
right.
Of, and then, by the way, the Romanos are in Chicago, and the Tikhon Choir is in Duburn, California, and the Washington Master Chorale. And on top of that, you imported two highly, highly sought-after operatic singers from Kiev, a tenor and a soprano, correct?
That's right, and you'll actually hear those on some of the excerpts that we have planned for the afternoon, and they're quite astounding. And, of course, you hear, I mentioned the term octavists before, and we'll hear them as well this afternoon.
Because, what's an octavist?
Well, an octavist is perhaps, in many ways, the most characteristic sound of Russian choral music. They're the bassists who sing way below the staff.
And they come through like thunder.
And they are incredible. Not only does it give the music its pyramidal structure in terms of balance from just a sheer musical standpoint, but the sheer ground that you stand on when you sing with those men is it's amazing.
Tell us about this first track we're going to hear. And this, I believe, also features a genuine Russian Orthodox cantor. Is that correct?
That's right. Actually, this first one, I'm not going to try and pronounce all of the Slavonic this afternoon. I just think, you know what? It's been a while since I practiced my Slavonic, but entitled Come Let Us Worship actually brings up a significant point about this recording and makes it unusual. Recordings of this work do not usually include the deacon and priest roles. We wanted to do that for the very reason that I just said. But the idea here is to present the worship of this work and the roles of the deacon and the priest, and moreover, their texts are absolutely essential, because when you look at this text of the deacon crying out, "Arise," and "Lord bless us," and then the priest, "Glory to the Holy Trinity," the choir's first amen, which is in the score, only makes sense, truly, if you've had those words. And
now,
then
this,
the response, what's that?
Now, I was just going to remind our listeners that, in fact, I haven't told them yet, so I'm going to tell them. This piece was written and first performed in 1915 during World War One.
Right.
And by the way, Rachmaninoff had already written the great Second Symphony, the great Second Piano Concerto,
mm-hmm.
And I believe the third as well. Yeah, the third, which he wrote in 1909.
Yeah, the third was already completed. And, of course, the Liturgy of St. John.
And the Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, which was his first piece, which was accused of not being very liturgical. This one, however, got plaudits even from his great teacher, Taneyev. So let's listen to this 1915 liturgical piece written by a man who had a bit of a struggle getting married in the Russian Orthodox Church, but we'll talk about that later. And this is entitled what, Jim?
This one has a title of Come, Let Us Worship.
Here we go. Oh. That is absolutely magnificent, and you got to really feel the magic when the choir comes in after the cantor. Should we call them the cantor there, or the deacon, or the priest?
Well, actually, you have the deacon and the priest. You have both.
Okay. But the magic of those. Well, how many voices were singing?
That was actually 77.
Which is about the number that it had at its 1950 premiere in Moscow.
That's correct.
They had 80. Now, is this all male, or are there women in there?
Oh, no. Women in here.
Now, they take the treble parts, right?
They do alto and soprano. When I hear the opening of this piece, what I'm reminded of is when we first went over to Russia, there were so many things to learn and so many things we'd never once heard or known. And one of those was what the Orthodox concept of the inside of the church is meant to give you. And that is, when you walk in, you're really greeted with heaven. You walk in, it's a greeting to all of your senses, whether it be sight,
yes,
where everything on the walls is these extraordinary paintings of saints.
And the smell.
And the smells, my goodness.
I've been to church in Moscow.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to interrupt you, Jim,
sure,
only because we have limited time in this first part, and I want to get into this incredible fifth track. And we're going to play as much as we can until right up to the break, take a short break, and come back. This fifth track is entitled Now Lettest Thou. Let's listen to it.
Thank you.
where you found that tenor, Dmitry Ivanchenko, but he is really something.
No, it was an extraordinary experience to stand in the room with him singing that.
So, I mean, he's got that floating tenor, no strain, you know?
None at all.
You know, there's none of that reaching for notes you so often hear in tenor voices.
And the thing is, you could tell that it's just straight out of both of his heart and his gut.
It's coming, yes, yes, you hear it. I mean, it's just as the conductor said, they wanted this to be a felt experience of people performing who believe and succeeded magnificently. We're going to be back with more of this brand new recording of the All-Night Vigil of Sergei Rachmaninoff. It's on the Paraclete label. You may not have heard the label. I'm sure you've heard it on this show. You can find it at all the places where recordings can be either bought as CD or downloaded. We'll be back with Jim Jordan in just a moment.
Attention, Blue Cross Blue Shield Medicare Supplement owners. What can you do about the 250% rate increase that is affecting you right now? You can call Brett Huffmaster at the Huffmaster Group. Brett is a licensed agent with over 10 different insurance companies. You need an independent agent who can study your situation and come up with a solution for you. Brett is an experienced, caring professional who wants to help you now. If you don't know insurance, know your agent, Brett Huffmaster at the Huffmaster Group. Call 888-447-6565 for a free quote today. That's 888-447-6565.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
What parent doesn't want their kids to share their faith and values? But how do you do it? How can you get your kids to own their faith? New research published in the book Faith and Family from Oxford University Press observes that while it's important to model the faith by going to church and saying family prayers, it's just as important that the children feel that their faithful family is a warm, loving, supportive, and affectionate place to grow up. Researchers found the strength and positivity of the relationships between moms and dads and their kids were among the biggest predictors of whether children would retain their faith as adults. To raise faithful kids, in addition to faithfully going to church and saying family prayers, be affectionate with your kids. Play as a family. Have weekly family days. Create a true community of love. Your children's faith depends on it. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
If you've enjoyed Father John Ricardo's gift of teaching and preaching in the past, his new book, Heaven Starts Now, is the book for you. In his inspiring and incisive way, Father John addresses the obstacles we all face in becoming mature disciples. How do we learn to forgive? How do we combat fear and understand suffering? How do we worship the Lord, love others, and surrender our lives to God? How do we become saints day by day? Order online at AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab. That's AveMariaRadio.net under the store tab.
Back with Dr. James Jordan, Jim Jordan, who is a longtime organist for Gloria Dei Cantoris, as well as an expert on chant and other related sacred music. He has brought to us this brand new recording on the Paraclete label of the All Night Vigil, written in 1915 by Sergei Rachmaninoff. And I think it's a good moment to mention what I had alluded to earlier, that just after the performance of his first symphony, which the Russian composer Glazunov conducted totally drunk and was a disaster. I mean, they had Sergei Rachmaninoff was hiding in the stairway after the performance. He went into a deep depression for 3 years, and he was helped out of his depression by a very early form of hypnotherapy. But he was also helped out of his depression by falling in love with his first cousin, Natalia Satina, and wanted to marry her, but since she was a first cousin, the Russian Orthodox Church said no. So what they did was, they went to some priests who actually reported to the Russian army, to the generals. They got married under the aegis of the Russian military, but they still had to get the okay from Tsar Nicholas II, which they got. And they got married, and they had an extremely happy marriage, devoted to each other. And out of that came the famous
Piano Concerto No. 2, which sounds a lot like a rhapsody that we played at the top of the program. We also mm-hmm. came out the Ravishing Symphony No. 2. So evidently, love and not just hypnosis had a lot to do with the revitalization of Mr. Rachmaninoff. And then I think he left Russia after 1905 because of the aborted revolution. He came back to Russia. He took over several very important posts in terms of the ballet and the orchestra. But in 1917, 2 years after this composition we're hearing, he had to leave because he had old ties to the Russian aristocracy. And he left Russia in 1917, never to return. And this, I think, caused him sadness throughout his life because he was Russian soul, right?
Well, it is the Russian soul. And when that type of thing happens, for instance, that's where the real turn came in his career. He became much more known as a pianist than a composer. I was thinking about this during break because, you know, when we were in school, we were, you know, I don't know what edition of Donald J. Grout's History of Music and Western Civilization we were using, but there wasn't much said about Russian composers except they were a nationalistic school. But when it came to Rachmaninoff, even less was said because of this very thing. He was truly known as a pianist. In fact, you can go on YouTube now and you can actually you can hear him performing. They have revitalized recordings from late in his life. But this work has really, I hate to use the word popularized, but it's certainly become a new level of fame in the past 20 years.
There are lots of recordings of the All-Night Vespers that none better than yours, my friend.
Well, this is
I've got five or six of them, and this one brought me in like none of the others.
Well, I will hasten to add, this is a straight-shot love affair of the heart for us, because we have had the great blessing of being in their churches. We've had the joy of standing there singing with their Russian Orthodox choirs over and, you know, before it was St. Petersburg and Leningrad, and, you know, you experience something with these people.
Well, I've been to Moscow twice for week-long visits.
Mm-hmm.
I've gone to their worship in those churches in the Kremlin.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt the same thing you're talking about. It's a whole different experience of this deep, deep spirituality, which is so disguised by communism.
Well, and this is one of the reasons that the contrast was so stark to us, because the first time we went, communism was still in full force. I can't remember if it was the first or second time we were there, we actually sang with them the first time they sang in their church on Easter Sunday at the return of some of this music. And deal, and I don't know how to put words to it.
Right, you can't.
You can't.
Yeah.
You just can't. And so when you come back to a score like this, and the chants that you just heard in those services are all through this work.
But he also added his own melodic gift, didn't he?
He did.
I mean, they're based upon the chant melodies,
mm-hmm.
but they're worked through his melodic gift in a way that, according to critics, does not do anything but enhance those original melodies.
Absolutely. You know, I think we talked last week, we may have chatted a little bit about Durifley.
Yes.
And his handling of chant.
Very similar, wouldn't you say?
Indeed. And a similar love and what I would call deep respect for it. Because he grasped it. It spoke to him in a way that he didn't try to engrave his signature upon it so much as marry his musical personality to it. And I think that's one of the reasons these movements, you know, some are based directly on chant. Some are simply his melodies, but they're so infused with that, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know. You couldn't tell. Because that his language is so closely related, and all the way through the work.
Now, the sixth track, Rejoice Virgin, tell us about that.
Well, if there's one movement from this work that you're going to hear from everything from a Russian choir to an American choir to a high school choir and college, it will be this movement. This is, I don't know how many college choir programs I've seen this on. Largely, it's about the shortest movement of the work. Structurally, one of the simplest, but its immediacy of beauty is unbelievable. And, of course, it's a text. It's the rosary. It's Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. You can hardly overstate the popularity of the text and the love for the text. And it's a very simple two-part form. But when you hear it, I mean, it builds the most extraordinary climax and then moves away. We had an experience with this when we sang over there after one of the concerts, I believe it was in the Hall of Columns. A gentleman came up to our director, and he looked at her and he said, "Tonight, our souls and your spirits met."
Oh, wow.
And it was after this work. And I've never forgotten. It's one of the reasons I wanted to have this track on the show today, because there's a reason beyond everything I just said that people pick this to do it, because it literally leaps off the page.
Might say this has the whole kitchen sink in it.
It really does. It does. And, it compacted in, and compacted is truly a poor choice of words. It's simply the density of what's there is incredible.
Well, let's listen to it. What's it called now? Rejoice Virgin?
This one is actually called Theotokos Virgin Rejoice.
Here we go, from the all-night visual of Sergei Rachmaninoff. Well, Jim, I think the Holy Spirit came down on that particular track.
Every time I hear it, what goes through my head and my gut is every place we ever did it. Because you see these people's faces.
When the ladies kind of come through the sound, they're rising to the top.
It's
divine. Astounding. It's sublime.
But, this raises an interesting point because this music, obviously it's late 19th century. This is romanticism,
This is neo-romanticism, full flight.
It really is. And there's a line between the depth of how you express this, of how it's worshipful, of how it's full of that emotion, but doesn't cross the line of self-indulgence.
No, it's not kitschy or weepy at all.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about that because the discipline of not only learning the music and what it requires to sing it, but the discipline that Rachmaninoff demonstrates in the forms of the composition or the orchestral sounds of vocal color.
It has a symphonic sound to the voice.
Absolutely. One of the most amazing things to me about the work as a whole is that the human voice is scored in a way that you would think. You are literally looking at his next symphony. You can find these types of colors throughout the work, and it's because he knew where to place the voice with a certain text to get.
And with which group? And which group of singers?
Absolutely, he knew the timbres to that degree.
Define timbre for our listeners and for me, because I use that word all the time. I'm not sure I know what it means.
Well, a simple definition is color, but timbre involves a number of things. It's not just color, but it's everything that goes to create the color. How is that person's voice constructed? Are they really a tenor, or are they a tenor or a baritone with a tenor extension, which means they might have more...
And do they sing with flat tone, or their vibrato, and all that comes
together, right? Right, exactly. That is all what constitutes the creation of timbre.
It's almost like coloring. It's like the coloring of the voice, so to speak, right?
It is. And that's something that we work with all the time, because it's how you create stylistic differences, or one of the principal ways you create stylistic difference is the changing, of, particularly for a singer, of the color of a vowel by its change of shape, by its location in the mouth. This is something that we worked on quite diligently and for a long time. Russian singing is quite different. The old school of Russian singing is quite different because of the depth in the body from which it's sung and the placement of the vowels in the mouth.
How many of those, you call them octaves?
Mm-hmm.
How many of them did you have singing?
Seven. Pardon me.
And were they all Russian, or were they American Russian Orthodox group?
Well, actually, we had several that were Russian. One man by the name of Glenn Miller, though, is quite American and has actually sung this work a number of times. He joined us. It was so we had a mix.
Well, I must say that I hope the reviewers, of which I plan to be one, realize how special this recording is in every way. Its packaging, its booklet, its engineering, its intention, and obviously in the beauty of the music. We've got another cut, which is entitled Blessed Art Thou Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us, why did you choose this particular cut?
I was hoping you'd ask me that question. That one of the reasons I wanted to do this is because it actually shows in a very clear way some of these symphonic colors it gives you a little bit of what we have come to expect as a Russian dance style. This is actually in a rondo form. There's a refrain throughout this. You know, this is taken from Psalm 119, and you get this constant repetition. But the repetition comes out as yadam bum beat, hum bum beat, dee dee. It's a, you know, it has a very Russian characteristic to it. And then the various verses completely change. And this is something, it's such a different sound from the movements that we have already heard. And part of the reason I chose it is because it relates back to what you played at the beginning. We all know Rachmaninoff primarily as a symphonic composer and one of piano concertos. And here is a wonderful example of how he used some of that knowledge right square in with the voice.
Now, will this particular track require all your forces?
Yes.
Including the soloist?
You know, I'm trying to remember if we get all the soloists. Actually, no. No, we don't. Not on this one.
Well, let's take a listen. This is track number 9 of the new recording of the All-Night Vigil, Sergei Rachmaninoff. Blessed Art Thou, Lord. That was a portion of track 9 of the new recording by the Gloria Dei Cantores of the All-Night Vigil of Sergei Rachmaninoff. And I think of all the recordings we've ever had on Church and Culture, this is the one I want to urge my listeners most strongly to get a hold of. It's widely available. It's distributed by the Naxos Group, which is, you know, everywhere, whether
you're in a Barnes & Noble or an Amazon or Barnes & Noble online or at the Paraclete website itself. Tell our listeners how they can go directly to Paraclete and get this.
You can go one of two ways. You can go to the website, which is simply www.paracletepress.com, and go under the recording section, or you can go straight to the recordings at www.paracleterecordings.com.
And before I let Jim Jordan go, I want to remind our listeners of the chant retreat that's going to be held at the Community of Jesus on Cape Cod in April. Those dates are what, Jim?
Those dates are actually April 5 through 8.
Right. And it's, again, a tremendous opportunity to be part of this amazing community that really use music in the way I think that is uniquely spiritual. And I also want to mention that in late October, they will be performing the great work by Ralph Vaughan Williams, Pilgrim's Progress. And I will be there on both nights. I believe it's the 27th and 28th of October, or it's the 28th
Fabulous.
And 29th. And I'll be there both nights because it's one of my favorite pieces of music, and I've never heard it performed live. Very excited. So, Jim Jordan, thanks for being a guest once again on Church and Culture. I'm sure it will be the last time.
Thank you.
And
always
best of luck with this recording.
Well, thank you so much.
And to all of you who are listening, we're going to take a short break and come back with another great guest. Thanks again, Jim.
This is Henry Root, your host for Putting On the Mind of Christ. Each week we go into the Ave Maria CD library. We pull on a talk or two to see what our Lord might have to say to us. Most of these talks are recorded at area gatherings and conferences. Most of the speakers are nationally known. The topics are varied, but they are all centered on the Lord, and they all are worth your listening time. You're back from Mass. It's not yet dinner time. Why not sit back and join us? Be fed on the Lord. Listen this and every Sunday afternoon at 3 for Putting On the Mind of Christ on 990 WDEL in the Metro Detroit area and 1440 WMAX in the Saginaw Valley. Putting On the Mind of Christ is brought to you by the Ave Maria Communications Guild.
Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Revival Study. In the 4th century, catechumens at the Easter Vigil would process through their First Communion chanting Psalm 23. It turns out Psalm 23 is actually a catechesis of the gateway sacraments of baptism, confirmation, and Eucharist. He leads me beside still waters. We emerge from the still waters of baptism as new creations. You prepare a table before me. Once we are baptized into the church, the Lord lays out the banquet of the Eucharist to nourish us. And you anoint my head with oil. In confirmation, our heads are anointed with oil, and we are forever sealed and identified with the cross of Jesus. And finally, and I shall dwell in the house of the Lord forever. The gateway sacraments we have received encourage us all the days of our lives to follow the path of holiness towards our Father's house.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Many foster kids spend much of their childhood feeling forgotten and lonely. How can we help them? Well, for Ann Evans, a homeschool graduate and a foster parent, the answer is simple. Find out more on today's Homeschool Heartbeat with your host, Mike Smith.
And what have been some of the best moments of your foster parenting journey?
Definitely the kids. People think that, oh, foster kids, they must get in trouble a lot or be bad kids. And obviously, after the trauma, that they can be a little high needs. But they're such sweet kids. And I love being able to do firsts with them. These kids, they might never have been to a zoo, never have been to a restaurant, and you get to be the person to do that with them. They just appreciate the experience of being read a book to, being sung a lullaby. I sang these kids some Bible lullaby songs when they were with me, and they're like, oh, I want to do the wise man built his house upon the rock. I want to sing that one again. And they were just so excited. So that was really cool to see their excitement.
Well, Ann, that's a good part. What are the challenging parts to being a foster parent?
To be quite honest, it's the adults. There's a lot of paperwork, in becoming a foster family, and there's a lot of bureaucracy. I've worked in the mental health field, so I can say this. Mental health workers are not always the easiest people to get along with. And, yeah, we're still doing paperwork, but it's worth it for the kids. It really is.
Well, thank you for stepping forward to take care of children who have no one else. As Jesus said in Matthew 25:40, inasmuch as you did it to one of the least of these, my brethren, you did it unto me.